This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street all across North Dakota. And of course, we're online too at prairiepublic.org, streaming at the same time we broadcast. Today is President's Day, and we'll share an encore episode of Main Street. Presidential scholar Rick Collin of Bismarck was with the State Historical Society of North Dakota when he visited with David Eisenhower, co-author of Going Home to Glory, a memoir of life with Dwight D. Eisenhower. David is the grandson of the famous general and former president, and his wife, Julie Nixon Eisenhower, is the daughter of the late President Richard Nixon. Here's Rick's interview with David Eisenhower.
Welcome, David. I have to tell you, as we begin our visit today, I have to tell you right off the top that my father and father-in-law were among the many millions of Americans who deeply admired your grandfather and the great service he gave to our nation, both as a soldier and as our 34th president. And also, my wife, Andrea, and I share a special connection with your grandfather. Mm-hmm. Our twin daughters, Sonia and Elizabeth, were born on President Eisenhower's 100th birthday, October 14th, 1990. And we never let the girls forget that every time the birthday rolls around.
I'll be darned.
I told
100th birthday, and that was an historic moment, too, because what was happening on the 100th birthday of Dwight Eisenhower is that Germany was reunifying.
That's right.
That was an extraordinary period in international relations. An entire era was ending. And a new one was starting in 1990, and the centennial of Dwight Eisenhower's birth was very much, I would say, infused with the transition that was occurring that year. So I remember it very well.
Well, I told Andrea she had to hold off on going into labor and delivery until the 14th of October. It had to happen on the centennial of your grandfather's birthday. Now, you mentioned you are the author, but the cover also says with your wife, Julie Nixon Eisenhower. Now, what was her contribution in helping you?
Well, her contribution was, I would say, tremendous. What happened, Rick, is some years ago, when the story was pretty fresh, I can remember taking out about 4 or 5 weeks. I just took them out. And I had a cassette player, and we had a secretary who was transcribing this story, and I just simply spoke the story into a cassette player, and we got these drafts back. And Julie and I just sort of going through it line by line, copy edited a first pass at what would become Going Home to Glory. We put that aside for a number of years, and then in the summer of 2009, when the combination of interests and inquiries and pressures and so forth prompt us to return to publishing. I've been 24/7 at the University of Pennsylvania for a number of years. Showed a number of potential projects to Simon & Schuster, and they liked this one as a start. And so we sat down to turn this informal memoir that I had dictated into a finalized book. And Julie's indispensable contribution in this was, I would say, Rick telling me when to stop. In other words, when enough had been done. Because when you get on a subject that is as close to your heart as this is to mine, I think that you may not know when to stop. You may not know what is of interest, what isn't. I just think Julie deserves, in my mind, a tremendous amount of credit because she helped me finalize it. And I think that's the best way to put it.
And, you know, you mentioned again, you talked about her tremendous contribution to the book. And I have to say, for all our concert goers listening today, I think another title for this book that you and Julia put out could be called Eisenhower Unplugged.
Okay.
Because you really you get a genuine sense of the man and his character and abilities as you read through it. And there's a lot of up close and personal.
Right. He's a vivid character. And I recreate. That's one thing I can see sort of looking over the final stages of this book is that at least in my mind's eye, I felt I captured him. I felt that at least the person that I knew was in these pages. Now, I've read books over the years about him or about major situations that involved him either as a general or as a president. And I hear him quoted I hear him described in other contexts, and I'm not sure that I recognize that individual necessarily. I think there is a sort of way of portraying political figures which is alien to me. The man I knew is in this book, and he was a very vivid figure, and it's hard for me to believe that he was not the same man in just about every context.
Now, what ages were you during these years? And from your viewpoint, as you lived with him and grew up with him, what was he like?
It starts January 20th, 1961, the day that John Kennedy is sworn in as president. That is also the day that Dwight Eisenhower leaves the presidency. And he goes home. He goes home to Gettysburg. And at that moment, I was 12 years old. I'm born March 31, so I'm almost 13. I'm entering my teen years. I've been grandson of the president. We have lived in Northern Virginia. We've now moved to Gettysburg by 1961. I grew up in and around the White House. Our lives are changing. We're all going back to Southern Pennsylvania to start a new life. I'm 13. He died in March of 1969. His state funeral in Washington, March 31st, was my 21st birthday. And so these are my years. From literally the age of 13 through the age of 21, achieving majority.
Now, you tell a very interesting story when you became engaged to Julie in the fall of 1968. It's a wonderful story, and there are many, many wonderful stories in this book, David, and this is, I think, one that particularly stands out. You were able to tell the rest of your family about what the engagement was all about, but you could not bring yourself to tell your grandfather. Why was that?
Well, my grandfather saw this coming. He met Julie, and he understood what an attractive girl she was and is. He could see that we were close, and so he saw it coming. And we were young. What Dwight Eisenhower did not appreciate in the 1960s was a sort of trend among people our age. We had a lot of friends, and they were getting married young for some reason. People got married in college. And so our attitude was, others can, why not this? And I think he was trying to deter it. I was conscious of this. And he's a hard fellow to sort of disagree with. It's just in his nature. It's not something that he wanted to be, but it was... As you can imagine, he'd been a general, and he'd been a president, and I was conscious of this and so forth. So I found that when the time came to sort of present this question to my family, that I got very shy. I did not want to hear disapproval from him. And what that prompted from him, and Ricky pointed this out, it's one of the key moments of the book, it prompted a letter from him in which he really asked me to think of him as a friend. Blessed my plans, and really gave me a gift, which grandparents can give grandchildren. That is a sort of affirmation that I will always treasure, and so on. This is a key moment in the book, and it sort of triggered a new phase in how I knew him. I came to know him as, I won't say a peer, but I'm saying I came to know him as a grown-up from that moment on.
And one of the things that strikes me in the letter also, we have a lot of Northern European residents here in North Dakota, and he talks about the Nordic hesitancy to open up man-to-man.
That's right. Well, see, the Eisenhowers were, I guess they would have included German in that. The Eisenhowers, Nordic is a broad tent, but Mamie was Swedish, or half Swedish and half English. The Eisenhower family was almost pure German. I think that he felt that, yes, there's a cultural reserve, and I think that he felt that this was something that maybe was true of our family, but he need not have really said that. I had no doubt growing up as a teenager that I had the sturdiest ally in him that anybody could possibly have. I just never doubted it. This was not something that everybody talked about, but I think it comes through in this chronicle. This is one thing that's a wonderful characteristic of this man who had such responsibility in World War II and the presidency. He was He was somebody that was good to know. He was somebody that he was a very stalwart friend and associate. I can just he certainly was for my sisters and me. As children and my father and mother as well.
Now, there are several interviews you list at the end of your book that you conducted as far back as 76 and 77.
Right. Yeah. Well, see, this was this is when I first had the idea for this, about 7 years after he died. I felt that publishers approached Julie and me in that period. Her father had resigned the presidency in 1974. We were newsworthy. Publishers were interested. And what I saw then was an opportunity to sort of make a record of some extraordinary experiences I had had and some and to describe unusual people that we had known. I wasn't sure what I was going to do with it, but we took that interval, that period, as an opportunity to do exactly that. One thing led to another, and I actually spent about 7 years working in almost complete isolation on a book entitled Eisenhower at War, which you mentioned at the head of the broadcast. This was a study of the Allied command in World War II, focusing, of course, on General Eisenhower, but it was essentially a history of the European theater. This was an offshoot of this original design. I took a Eisenhower biography to publishers, and what I got in return was support and encouragement to do a war, study the war. Along the way, I'd accumulated these drafts and laid the foundations for future books in this area and in other areas as well, and that's where we're proceeding to.
Presidential scholar Rick Collin talking with David Eisenhower about his grandfather, President Dwight D. Eisenhower. Coming up, we'll hear the story behind the title of the book, Going Home to Glory.
February is a month for leaps. Picking a candidate, an extra day on the calendar, and Morning Edition from NPR News is there for all of it. So take the leap with us. 2020 election. It's time to listen.
The Minot Chamber Chorale is performing their yearly Winter Classical Masterpiece Concerts on Sunday, March 1st at 3 p.m. in the Ann Nicole Nelson Hall on the campus of Minot State University. This year's concert features the Norwegian composer Kim Andre Arneson's Magnificat, featuring visiting artist Tess Altaveros, and accompanied by strings, organ, and piano. The concert is free and open to the public. A free will offering will be accepted to help support programming. More information is available at MinotChamberChorale.org or on the Minot Chamber Chorale's Facebook page.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Today we're observing President's Day with an encore interview about President Dwight D. Eisenhower, featuring Rick Collin in a conversation with the president's grandson, David Eisenhower.
David, how did you come up with the title for the book?
The title is taken from a tombstone for an individual who had reached her maturity would have been a she would have been an aunt of Dwight Eisenhower's, Lydia Eisenhower, who died at the age of 17. Her tragedy and other tragedies in that generation were probably factors that propelled the Eisenhowers to pick up stakes in Pennsylvania and move west. I think they wanted to escape the memory of losing a lot of children in childbirth and so forth. I think that her story and that Eisenhower generational story is a reminder that the great migration westward and so forth was propelled by the hope for a better life, a better day. And Lydia was somebody who died apparently very devout and confident that her worldly trials would mean some sort of redemption or salvation for her. And so the idea that she had been going home to glory is carved onto her tombstone. Dwight Eisenhower, in writing his informal memoir At Ease, quoted the entire tombstone. And when I was conceiving this book a long time ago, I was very struck by that. And I thought to myself that Granddad was saying something very important in this section of his memoir, and that was that he felt that the character the stoicism and so forth that earlier generations of Eisenhowers had had experienced and so on were very formative in his outlook, and he felt this was a sign of great character. Well, that phrase, going home to glory, stuck in my mind, and I've never considered an alternative to that title. And when the time came to put a title on this book, I got a suggestion from the publisher, and I replied with that suggestion, and they accepted it immediately. And because I think it captures the book. It's a this is a book about transitions. They're going home from the White House, from Gettysburg. They seek they move on to different phases in their life. They're aging, the Eisenhowers, like in Mamie, but they're in transition. And every transition is a kind of improvement in a way, because their lives got fuller, if not more comfortable, certainly fuller and richer and better.
And that transition, one of the first segments of that transition was this eccentric request, as you title it in your book, where he asked President Kennedy to work to have his five-star rank as general of the Army restored. Why was it so important to him to have that five-star rank restored?
Well, you know, I do tell the story, as it was told to me. The request puzzled President Kennedy, and I don't purport to explain it wholly in the book. My view of it is that what Dwight Eisenhower was saying by becoming general again, among other things, Rick, this meant it meant things administratively. He was able to keep certain staff on and things like that. But what it meant above all is that President Dwight Eisenhower was reminding his followers and reminding historians as he left the White House, that the Eisenhower presidency of the 1950s was really consecrated to the task of winning the peace. His bond was with the GI of World War II, the GI who fought in Europe and in the Far East, and they had won the war. It was up to statesmen after the war to win the peace, and that's what it had been all about. That's the way I interpret it. I think there's great symbolism involved there, and it's not because he did not revere the presidency or consider the presidency to be the high point of his life. He did. But he had been a president of a certain kind, and he had been a steward for the greatest generation that had fought these two wars simultaneously overseas.
And he'd been a career military officer, as you pointed out. Graduated from West Point, was it 1915?
Yes. He was a career military officer. He loved the Army, and he was very proud of West Point and was always an Army man. There's no doubt about that. One of the great powers, one of the great strengths that he brought to office, and we look for specific strengths in presidents at specific times. And what Eisenhower brought to the office in 1952 and 53 was the insight of a soldier statesman, and that's what he was. He was a soldier statesman in World War II who had been a diplomat as well as a strategist. He had served, he had been the first commander of the NATO alliance, which was a diplomatic post as well as a military one. And the combination of military and diplomatic backgrounds and perspectives were just necessary in 52 and 53. The overriding problem of that era was the Korean War, the threat of general war in Europe. And he had the background, the ability, and the network to address that problem and to take steps back from general war with the communist world. That's what we achieved in that period.
One of the things I really like about this book is you really, again, as I mentioned earlier, you get to get a sense of the man as a person. You point right. out that Eisenhower was an artist who painted a great deal. He gave many of his paintings away, and you write, quote, "One can learn a great deal about Dwight Eisenhower through his artwork."
No question about it. He was somebody that looked at the world you know, I offer sort of a review of his various paintings. What I see in them is a mind that is given to ideals, even to absolutes, because he did representational paintings, landscapes, portraits of ordinary people, portraits occasionally of historic figures such as Lincoln, George Washington, but what I see in there is a mind that sort of fastens on the dominant meaning of a scene or of a portrait. When he is doing a winterscape, it is absolute zero, just like North Dakota, 25 below. When he's doing fall landscapes, you see explosions of colors that heighten, even exaggerate the effect of the season and so forth. So one can learn a lot about his turn of mind, but it was also, he felt that the world was a wondrous place. I think we all do. And he just enjoyed observing it. I suppose keeping some sort of, making some sort of diary in a way of scenes and places that meant so much to him. And he saw many places in the world.
When did he start painting?
I believe he started in, you know, there's sort of mixed evidence on this. The standard story is that he took it up as president of Columbia University in the late 1940s, just before he got into politics. As the story goes, he was watching the great portrait artist Thomas Stevens do a painting of Mamie, and he began asking Stevens questions about how painting was done, and he was fascinated by the technique of it, and then decided to take it up as sort of a hobby. That's the story. There is evidence that he was sketching in the late months of World War II during the European campaign, and that means that his hobby might have been inspired by his British colleagues. Churchill was a painter, Arthur Tedder, who was his British deputy for air during the European campaign, was also a painter. There were a number of painters that he ran into, and I think he admired their ability to become absorbed in painting and to use it as sort of a relief from official responsibilities. I think he actually began to sketch perhaps in late 45. I don't know the origin of it for sure. I know the standard story. I did not tell the standard story in this book because I suspect that there's more to it.
Rick Collin in a discussion with David Eisenhower, the grandson of President Dwight D. Eisenhower. Coming up, the family travels with the former president to Europe, and we hear about some of the historical figures of the day.
I'm Dave Thompson. What goes into how we write? Well, the essential ingredients of writing are simplicity. As one book said one time, use the plain word instead of the fancy. Use the nickel word instead of the dollar word. And also make it sure that it's very understandable to everybody who's listening. Remember, we in radio are competing with other noise. When you're listening to the radio, you're probably in your car, you're listening to the tires against the roadway, you're listening to the wind whistling. So you have to cut through that, and the way to do that is simple and direct language. I also use a lot of actuality, meaning the newsmakers talking, because I want them to say it, not just me. Listen for regional news on Prairie Public, telling North Dakota's story.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Today we're observing President's Day with an encore interview about President Dwight D. Eisenhower, featuring Rick Collin in a conversation with the president's grandson, David Eisenhower.
David, before we do a quick take on some of the historic figures of the day that your grandfather commented on, you have a hilarious story in the book about a trip that you, your sister Anne, and others took to Europe with your grandfather. I think it was 62. Your sister Anne's playing records on a record player on the trip.
Right.
Dale Shannon's great hit "Runaway" irritates your grandfather. He's shocked to hear about two of his favorite songs, "El Solo Mio" and "Army Blue," had been turned by Elvis Presley into hit records.
right, exactly. Yeah, well, that's right. And, you know, he was not real modern that way. And we were also living in pretty close quarters on that trip. That was 1962. That's also a moment where traveling through Europe for about over a month with my grandfather at the age of 14 my first exposure to Europe, and this is only 17 years after World War II, and it was my opportunity to really sort of get a feel for the connection between Dwight Eisenhower and the soldiers in Europe and that area of the world. The images of that trip, the shadows, the lights, the personalities, and so forth are just indelible in my mind.
So he definitely was not an Elvis fan, even though It's Now or Never and Love Me Tender were huge hits.
right. Yeah, exactly. That's right. No, he was not an Elvis fan, but Elvis was inducted into the Army.
Yes.
In the late 50s, Ike was president, and he admired Elvis for being that. He was a good soldier, and he sacrificed a lot of earnings at the peak of his career and so forth to go off to the service. And so I think that he probably admired Elvis in a roundabout way. But, I think he had a feeling that, there were certain, items in American culture that were sort of sacrosanct. And one were the Army songs and stuff like that.
Let's talk a little bit about his take on some of the historic figures of the day. I want to go down just a brief list here.
Yes.
President Kennedy. Now, I told a friend that he respected JFK, but didn't particularly like him.
Well, I think that's about as accurately as it could be put. I think he saw that John Kennedy was an able leader, and actually, what happens in going home to glory? I took that as a general rule into looking into this relationship, and then I lined up the documents that I had on it. I looked at their correspondence, and what I could see was a gradual warming between the two. I don't know that it could not have become a friendship, but credit for that goes to John Kennedy. The thing about Kennedy is he was an opposition figure. He's correcting perceived wrongs or oversights in the Eisenhower years and so forth. But he is a person of really fine manners. He's very courteous towards Dwight Eisenhower. And I think that Eisenhower was grateful for these courtesies, and I think he appreciated the very important areas in which Kennedy finally consulted him on the Civil Rights Act, as it was being submitted in 1963, consulted him again on the Test Ban Treaty summer of 1963. I actually asked Eisenhower to assume a role in lining up support in the Senate and so forth for confirmation of that treaty. And I think that they had a... successors and predecessors in the presidency generally do not get along. And I think that little by little, I think that there was some warmth there. But it was a very, correct relationship when Kennedy assumed office. No question about that.
And shortly after Kennedy took office, of course, the Bay of Pigs fiasco, the failed invasion to overthrow Castro's Cuba. And Eisenhower, Kennedy leaned heavily on him after that.
Yes, he did. We wrote a pretty extended description of that event in Going Home to Glory. I think that what I decided to do there was to present the story as what Eisenhower told associates it unfolded. And so this is the Eisenhower side of that story. I think scholars looking at the Bay of Pigs would look at it in a somewhat broader context. And I think they would question whether Kennedy had any real interest in trying to intervene in Cuba and so forth. The thing that made the Bay of Pigs an important episode in Cold War is that by consolidating Castro, but doing so through a failed attempt to overthrow him, what our misadventure did was it sort of tightened up the relationship between Havana and Moscow and made introduction of Soviet missiles there possibly more likely. The idea that the Soviets would introduce missiles into the Western Hemisphere was a contingency that the Eisenhower administration followed very carefully from the moment Castro took power in 59. The threat of missiles in our hemisphere was deemed unacceptable, and Bay of Pigs was something that probably accelerated it. But the good news is President Kennedy, when confronted with the challenge in Cuba, did handle that crisis in a masterful way, and the world became safer as a result of it.
Let's talk about Lyndon Johnson and his relationship with your grandfather. Very, very interesting, and you go into a lot of interesting detail in the book.
Well, Lyndon Johnson was somebody that Eisner had worked with as president. Lyndon Johnson had been in the Senate. He was Senate Majority Leader, and they fashioned a kind of bipartisan spirit in the late 50s and actually got quite a bit done. There was a lot left undone, but they got a lot done. They had a lot in common. They were two figures that probably really could have been close and were close personal friends. They both enjoyed farmsteads. The hill country in Texas is strikingly like southern Pennsylvania, if you've ever visited it. In fact, it's sort of peopled by the same kind of folk. I think they had the same. They had a lot of friends in common. They were friends, and so I think that they interacted that way. They were also Johnson is somewhat older than John Kennedy, so you don't have this generational difference that you had in the case of Kennedy. And Johnson was also a beleaguered president, and I think he felt that his friendship with Dwight Eisenhower was important psychologically. He was a person who was thrust into the presidency because of tragedy. He was by nature a senator and legislator. And on that subject, one thing I wanted to mention, Rick, is that a person that I did not know at Exeter, though I covered my Exeter years, is somebody that I've heard about and from in a roundabout ways since, who is quite well known in North Dakota, and that is your Senator Kent Conrad.
Yes.
He's had a terrific career in the Senate, and I know he's very widely respected in Washington. I hear a lot about him, and I'm proud that we went to the same school.
Excellent. I was going to ask you, getting back to Johnson now, more on his relationship with Ike. Johnson really, during the whole Vietnam buildup, I'm struck in the book how much he went to Ike for advice.
Well, he did. And I think that there's even more to the story. I wrote the story from the documents that I had, and I think there's even much, much more to it. Johnson's first question for Eisenhower in 1965 was, you know, Democrats are his party did not take the 17th parallel in the division between North and South Vietnam very seriously. They had not negotiated it. This is something that was done during the Dulles era, Dulles Eisenhower era, and they were not sure that defending South Vietnam was worth the candle. So his first question for Eisenhower was, "You did not intervene with troops in 1954. We're thinking of doing it in 1965." Do you see that as consistent, or do you think that the region is really not worth defending? And Eisenhower's answer was the region is worth defending. And I think that that's what Johnson wanted. But Johnson was surrounded by a lot of skeptics, people who did not think that the theater of operations was really worth it. And so I think that he appreciated having Eisenhower's support. That was part of it. Then what it evolved into was a very close, careful communication over a period of about two and a half years on strategy. And Eisenhower's advice was to intervene with as much force as possible to win this war as quickly as possible. Johnson did not feel he could do that. So privately, Eisenhower was, I would say, semi-critical of the way the war was being waged. Publicly, he stood behind President Johnson. And I think probably reasoned that war, like everything else at the national level, is a very complicated issue. And there were probably very good reasons for Johnson's gradualism. And Eisenhower would not have waged a gradualistic war, perhaps, but he was not going to second-guess Lyndon Johnson publicly over the way he did wage it.
Unfortunately, we only have a couple more minutes, but very quickly, his take on Barry Goldwater, a 1964 Republican nominee for president, ran against Johnson.
Yeah, I think the big issue between Goldwater and Eisenhower in 1964 was party strategy going into the fall elections on civil rights. And Goldwater really, and Eisenhower had different objectives. Goldwater's objective was not to win the 1964 election. It was to make a statement. It was to use the Republican Party as a vehicle for making a statement about philosophy. And I think he was indifferent as to the outcome of 64, and Eisenhower wasn't. And so Eisenhower believed in substance and as a matter of political strategy that the Republican Party should join hands with Democrats and step up to the 64 Civil Rights Act. Goldwater formulated a constitutional objection to that bill and voted against it. And I think that was the real issue between the two of them. Otherwise, I'm struck by how much these two men had in common. Goldwater is a Westerner. He's somebody who loved gadgets and technology, and I cover Granddad how much he loved gadgets. And he was an Air Force man, and he was an aviator. And my grandfather was an admirer of aviators. And Goldwater is a conservative, and Eisenhower is certainly a conservative. I think that must come through. In this, they probably would have agreed on many points, but they did disagree on that. And Eisenhower felt that Goldwater's willingness to be provocative on civil rights was irresponsible. And he was right. Goldwater did not, from what I've been able to read since, Goldwater did not intend to win the 1964 election. He really gave himself no chance at all, and so he waged a sacrificial candidacy, which a lot of people say has made a big difference long range. But certainly in the short range, it baffled Eisenhower and baffled other national Republican leaders.
It did, and it buried, of course, Johnson buried him in a landslide.
If you look at the pattern of the 64 election, there's no doubt that the issue in 64 was enforcement of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. That is the exact way the nation broke.
They did. They did with the Deep South going for Goldwater. Real quick, I love your story in the book about how Ike's favorite movie, a 1951 film called Angels in the Outfield, he watched over and over again. I think you said 38 times.
That's what Sergeant Mooney said. I'm not sure of that figure, but you know, it wouldn't surprise me. I actually did the math. How many nights a year would he have to watch Angels in the Outfield to see it 38 times? I know I saw it in his presence at least six times.
That's the beauty of your book, David. It gives you everything from those kind of insights to his relationships with Presidents Johnson, Kennedy, Barry Goldwater, on and on. So
yeah, well, I'll tell you, thank you for raising these things and allowing me to remember the real pleasure it was to put this book together. It's now 50 years ago. This is a memoir chronicle of a time exactly 50 years ago. It was a great era in American history. And in my lifetime, it was the golden time of my youth, and I just talking about it and assembling it has been a complete pleasure.
And we've been visiting today with David Eisenhower, the author of Going Home to Glory, A Memoir of Life with Dwight D. Eisenhower, 1961 to 69. Thank you, David, for a very interesting visit today.
Thanks, Rick.
Thank you.
That was presidential scholar Rick Collin visiting with David Eisenhower about the book he co-authored about his grandfather, Going Home to Glory, A Memoir of Life with Dwight D. Eisenhower. Next on Main Street, a call for nominations for the North Dakota Native American Hall of Honor.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
What does it mean to be politically engaged? Researcher Eitan Hirsch says it's less about following the news and more about talking to your neighbors.
Instead of hating a random person who says they're Republican or says they're a Democrat, they would say, is this a neighbor that I can convince to move in my direction?
How to Acquire Political Power, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Nominations are being sought for the 2020 class of inductees to the North Dakota Native American Hall of Honor. The hall is located in the North Dakota Heritage Center and State Museum in Bismarck on the Capitol grounds. It recognizes Native Americans who've gone above and beyond in representing their tribe and culture. The first induction into the Hall of Honor took place in 2016. Scott Davis, executive director of the North Dakota Indian Affairs Commission, shared some opening remarks at that ceremony. Here's an excerpt.
The whole purpose of tonight is their stage, the inductee stage. The whole intent is tonight to have that family, that inductee, to talk about their story, about their journey in life. But keep in mind, you know, this whole story is just the beginning of something that our relatives have accomplished, a lifelong accomplishment. And the second thing about what we're doing here tonight, together tonight as nations, is that it's educating the world. The 90,000 people that come through these hallways every year, 90,000 come visit this Heritage Center every year. And what do they see? What do they listen to? What do they want to learn about us? What did they want to learn about our heroes, our warriors? Now this is our time. This is our chance. This is a small way to educate the world of who we are in the value of our heroes. And the last thing for the young ones in the room, I hope you listen and watch and look at what you can become by working hard, by willing to go somewhere where maybe it's a little uncomfortable. Because for some reason, the ones you're going to see here tonight and listen to, for some reason, they went somewhere where it was uncomfortable. They were willing to go someplace. They were willing to step out of their comfort box to help serve their community, help serve their people, put themselves last, sacrifice their own lives for the good of our people, of our nations, of our tribal nations. So you young ones, I really want you to think about that. And maybe, just maybe, if you could replicate their values of the inductees, the spiritual strength that these individuals had, the courage, the wisdom, maybe someday you'll be up here as well.
There were 7 honorees that first year, and each year, Mokoche Studios of Bismarck has prepared video profiles about each of them. The first person honored at the 2016 ceremony was Anthony McDonald, and today we offer it again. First, you'll hear from then-Congressman Kevin Kramer, followed by McDonald himself, then Myra Pearson, former Spirit Lake Tribal Chair, Nancy Green Robinson, former Tribal Treasurer, historian Eric Longy, and Father Charles Luty of the Seven Dollars Parish.
Well, the reason I think Tony is so worthy of being inducted into the North Dakota Native American Hall of Honor is there's really two overriding themes and characteristics that I think of when I think of Tony. One is Tony chose to be a victor rather than a victim. That in and of itself is inspirational to all of us. But what I love is that Tony uses that victory in his personal life to build bridges. He's a healer.
When I was between 14 and 15, my mother died. That was in 53. So that's the year that the government was trying to Americanize the Indian. And we're sending them all out to the cities, relocation. And my dad left. He wasn't home 10 days after Mom died, and he left.
People talking about, you know, life experiences and, you know, hardships and stuff like that, struggles that they've been through. And you know, and he's one of those people as well. And to come this far and share that with, you know, the people of this community, you know, people have, again, somebody to fall back on and understand that they're not the only ones that struggle. And there's always someone here to help them. You know, a lot of people depend on Mr. McDonald.
I did everything you usually do. I played ball. I graduated valedictorian. I got to do just about everything I wanted to do, I guess. That's where my rodeo come in, because I grew up on horses.
Tony McDonald is actually one of our spiritual role models for the Spirit Lake Tribe. And He's one that you could call upon for words of wisdom.
He also does ceremonies for people who are grieving and coming out of grieving, you know. He does those ceremonies as well. And I don't think I've ever heard of that family telling someone, no, I can't.
You can't count it. It's so immeasurable. Because every day he's helping somebody.
When you speak of culture and arts, we have ceremonies and customs that you know that we like to follow, and there are beliefs that we have to follow as the Dakota people. Tony knows all that.
Whatever you're doing, do it the best you could. Then you don't have to come back and do it the second time.
Incorporates his knowledge, you know, into these wakes and into the funerals and into the counseling.
We have a value system that is pretty. You couldn't compare anything with it. It used to be when I was growing up. I seen the values in our people that they lived it. They didn't talk about it. They lived it.
1983, Tony was ordained as the first permanent Indian deacon in the state of North Dakota. He tries to connect the culture and the faith life that people are called to live, and that we recognize that Christianity, the core of the Catholic faith and the core of the Dakota culture, are not incompatible.
I know a lot of great preachers, but very few of them are a sermon. Tony's one of these guys who not just preaches a good sermon, but he is a good sermon.
That was audio from the video profile of 2016 Native American Hall of Honor inductee Anthony McDonald, produced by Makoche Studios of Bismarck. Nominations for 2020 are welcome through Monday, March 2nd. Nominees can be living or in memoriam. The induction ceremony will occur in September as part of the Tribal Summit and United Tribes Powwow. You can learn more about the Hall of Honor and submit an application at indianaffairs.nd.gov/hall-of-honor. The program is a partnership of the North Dakota Indian Affairs Commission, the State Historical Society of North Dakota, and the State Historical Society Foundation. Coming up on Main Street, Dakota Datebook.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them, in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
Hi, I'm Barb Gravel, host of the television show Prairie Musicians on Prairie Public, Oakland.
Break out these chains, let's burn it down.
Anchorage.
You're drowning, let me know, cause I've never been much of a swimmer.
New Orleans.
That's crispy treats and noodles, Home Alone, Macaulay Culkin. Cause sometimes, I need more space than stars can give me, more sky than God provides me.
Columbus, Georgia. What do these places have in common? They're some of the hometowns of NPR's Tiny Desk Contest winners. The 2020 edition is on, and we'd love to see someone from North Dakota, Eastern Montana, or Northwest Minnesota win it all this year. So Prairie musicians over 18, soundcheck, and then film yourself performing an original song in front of the Tiny Desk of your choice. Then upload it onto YouTube and do a little dance for luck, because it'll be judged by a distinguished panel that includes multiple Grammy winner Brittany Howard of the Alabama Shakes. The winner will perform at the iconic Tiny Desk in D.C., and embark on a 10-city U.S. concert tour with NPR Music. Entries must be in by March 30th. Just go to npr.org/tinydeskcontest for complete rules and to upload your clip.
Are you ready?
We're so thrilled to welcome the winner of the Tiny Desk Contest!
The 2020 NPR Tiny Desk Contest. Go for it, Prairie musicians!
This is Dakota Datebook for February 17th. Alfred Dickey was the first Lieutenant Governor of North Dakota. He was also a citizen of Jamestown and a supporter of the public good. So in January of 1901, he called a meeting with the intention to create a free reading room for Jamestown. Unfortunately, Mr. Dickey proved too sick to go to his own meeting, so he was represented by his friend, Mr. Smart.
It was through SMART that the attendees learned that Mr. Dickey intended to donate most of the supplies needed for the new room and would even hire a custodian for 3 nights a week. Unfortunately, Mr. Dickey couldn't shake his illness, and 3 days after the meeting, he died without ever seeing his idea come to fruition. Shortly after his death, his son, Alfred E. Dickey, held another meeting with the library committee and guaranteed them that he would fulfill his father's promises. About a month later, around this date, Jamestown happily opened the reading room in the Opera House block, leaving it free and open to the public, although for $1 a year, library cardholders could borrow books from there. This spot proved popular, and in 1908, the city decided to support the library with taxes, and in January 1909, they moved it to City Hall and hired the first full-time librarian, Miss Alice Paddock. Alfred E. Dickey continued to support the library even after his death in 1910, leaving the board of directors $20,000 to find a new library location and a $15,000 endowment for upkeep of the building. In 1980, the National Register of Historic Places registered the Alfred Dickey Free Library as a historical site. They have since received two more endowments, one of $13,000 from Morris Beck and another of $20,000 from Chester Hodge for buying books of nonfiction. However, the largest support comes from the taxes and generous donations from the people of Jamestown and Stutsman County. So even though Alfred Dickey never saw the fruits of his idea, there's no doubt about the impact of his vision. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lucid Thomas. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Hey kids, do you have a story to tell? Enter it in the 2020 PBS Kids Writers Contest. We're looking for amazing original stories from writers in kindergarten through the third grade. So tap into your imagination, break out the crayons and magic markers, and start writing today. When you enter, you'll have the chance to win and see your story published online. First place winners in each grade level will receive prizes and have their stories featured on the Prairie Public website. Everyone who submits a story gets a certificate of achievement. Find the rules and entry forms along with a writer's guide to help you brainstorm and develop plots at prairiepublic.org. Deadline to submit your original story is Friday, March 27th. The 2020 PBS Kids Writers Contest. Enter today.
It's President's Day, and what if we made the presidency nonpartisan? That's what North Dakota attorney Lily Shonek would like to see. She joins us tomorrow on Main Street to discuss her campaign for a nonpartisan president, an effort she hopes will ease the nation's political tensions. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.